Good afternoon. Welcome to part two of Fraud Goes to the Movies, where I continue my conversation with film critic Alan Cerny about movies which have a fraud and white-collar crime theme. I apologize for the last episode where I had some lingering noise at the end. Hope everybody's having a great 2024. Good afternoon, everybody, and hope everybody's having a great 2024 so far. This is part two of a two-part podcast where fraud and white-collar crime goes to the movies. I'm very proud to have my guest host here, Mr. Alan Cerny. If you listened to the last podcast, I hope you did, Alan is a movie critic, among other things. He's been reviewing movies for many years. He's won awards for his writing. Personally, I think he's a fantastic movie reviewer. Generally, if Alan likes a movie, I'm going to go see it because I'll like it as well. So, Alan, before we get started with the movies, I want to just talk for a few minutes about the process of how a critic watches a movie, because I'm kind of interested in that. What do you look for in, since this is a fraud and white-collar crime podcast, when you're looking at what essentially is a drama, because I think we can agree that fraud movies of this type are dramas.
Yeah.
What are you looking for?
Well, I don't watch movies, I think, the way that a lot of critics do. A lot of critics are a lot more analytical than I am. I have to feel it in my gut if a movie is working, and even if the movie doesn't make logistical sense, if it's in my gut and I'm having a good time and sympathizing with the characters, I have a strong empathy. Roger Ebert used to call movies engines of empathy, right? And if I'm relating, even if I have nothing in common with the person on screen, if I'm relating to them, That goes a long way for me, in watching movies. So I don't really watch movies on an analytical level. I can't really break them down like that. I have to feel it. And when I'm watching something that really is something I'm really into, I have a phrase that I say to people, and it sounds corny and trite, but I really feel like it's true. Movies aren't windows, they're doors, if they're working right. Okay? You can look through a window, but you walk through a door.
And, I like that. It's interesting.
And a good movie, you're in it with them. You're standing right next to them in the movie, you're feeling it as opposed to just as a passive observer. And that's kind of what I look for in a great movie. If a great movie can bring me into it in a way that I don't normally do things while I watch movies, right? I don't like fold laundry or anything like that. You know, it's like I'm in it, and I kind of give it my 100% attention. So I don't take notes when I watch a movie on a critical screen. There are a lot of things in my life where I can't remember crap, but I remember how movies work. And I over the years, I feel like I've gotten better at breaking down movies kind of on a technical proficient level. But even a movie that is not technically proficient but has strong performances, strong writing, you know, you can fall. Like... I'll throw an example. Clerks is a great movie that's really crappily made. Okay,
but black and white, wasn't it?
Yeah. And it basically looks like a shot on the security cameras that are in a, one of those.
Listening, that was Kevin Smith's first film, right?
Yeah, it's like I said, it's not very well made, but it's strong because the performances feel genuine and the script is great and. You know, so a lot of people watch movies and they start at zero. And then the movie has to build up to whatever percentage they, in their mind, if you're going to aggregate like Rotten Tomatoes, whatever percentage is in their mind. I always start at 100 and then the movie detracts or stays there. Sometimes it stays there. There are great movies that stay there. Sometimes, you know, some levels. So I always start at 100. So when I sit down on movies for the first time, I'm open and ready, and I'm not expecting the greatest thing ever, but I am giving them a huge benefit of the doubt, and you know, that way I'll just feel disappointed that I'll get there instead of surprised at how good something turns out to be. So you know, a lot of critics do it the other way, you know, and that's not for been my way.
You know, it's a point you make is, once again, talking about Glenn Gary, Glenn Ross, for those from the last podcast, remember, Glenn Gary, Glenn Ross, I think it was number 9 or 8 on your rankings. And it, once again, a truly, truly superb movie. But I remember watching that, and, you know, it was the opening with Jack Lemmon. Jack Lemmon is having issues, and then he slowly build into the initial meeting with Alec Baldwin. Mm-hmm. And, you know, once again, we're putting that in fraud and white-collar crime context. If you're just looking at that movie at the beginning and you're wondering if this is a fraud movie about fraud or white-collar crime, it doesn't really start off that way. And then suddenly, when Alec Baldwin begins a speech, and once again, there's some profanity on this podcast, but not that much.
I'm
certainly not going to read it for verbatim. But once Alec Baldwin starts that speech, suddenly for me, I was sucked into it, and suddenly I realized, okay, now I'm watching a film about people who, and they may not be doing something wrong, but they have to be motivated to get into it. And that's this, that, you know, Alec Baldwin's speech, of course, is motivational in a way.
In quotes.
In quotes, that's right. Yeah. But for me, that, you know, that centered it for me. And then, of course, as you realize what's more and more of what's going on, what these guys are actually, you know, once again, selling in quotes. Mm-hmm. To me, that's what really did it, in the sense that, okay, now I'm watching a film about people who, if they don't know they're doing something wrong, they should. And certainly, with somebody like that, when Alec Baldwin pretty much lays it on the line and said, "This is what you're going to do," or, you know, "Hit the bricks, pal."
Yeah.
Quotes in there. That's what framed it for me. So to use your analogy, you know, I'm not a movie critic. I'm at the point in my life now, Alan, where if I don't walk out of movie theaters because I've paid my money. I'm usually in there with my family. But if I'm watching something that isn't, if I don't want to finish it, I'm not starting to finish it.
Yeah.
A movie like that, and certainly the movies you've mentioned on before that I've seen, just have that power where they drag me in. Drag is the wrong word, but they just pull me in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, The Sting, the last movie you talked about in the last podcast, just from the very opening, you know, it just pulled me in. And then suddenly to me, what was amazing is you're entering this world. And we're talking about The Sting here. You're entering this world where people are ripping each other off. Now, the fact that Paul Newman and Robert Redford are ripping off another gangster doesn't excuse the fact that these guys are ripping people off anyway.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But it frame it in such a way where I'm just having such a damn good time watching it, I could care less. I mean, they could be ripping off, you know, my grandmother. I'd still be watching it.
And that's the thing about a lot of white-collar crime films, I think, is that I think a lot of it in the audience's eyes when they're appreciating what they're watching is like, because it's a little fantasy to us too.
Good point.
Obviously some of the schemes of white collar crime in real life are, you know, complicated and difficult. But, you know, movies break down things to their essentials. So you're watching somebody doing something that's not exactly illegal, and they're getting away with it, and they're getting money, and they're going, gee, you know, everybody wants easy money, right? So I think that's a big. Even one of the movies that didn't put on this list, but is absolutely white-collar crime, it's just probably not the white-collar crime you might expect, is a movie called Quiz Show.
Oh, that's a great movie.
Throw that in there. Maybe we'll start off with
Let's start off with Quiz Show. That's not in the ranking. This is just something Alan brought out. Alan, why don't you talk about Quiz Show?
Quiz Show is based on a real event that happened on at NBC about a game show called 21.
I think it's important to put it in context. What year was this?
Oh, 1950-something, right? And back then, you know, people were, what else are you going to do? We didn't have the billions of choices that we have today. So then the TV came on at 8 o'clock at night, and you watch whatever was there. Well, one of the shows I watched on NBC was 21, the game show. And people would, basically, the gist behind the show was that everybody had, I mean, it was, the questions that were being asked for historical in context are really difficult questions that not everybody could answer. And everybody was like watching it just to see the brain power on display. Well, one of the guys was winning constantly, played by John Turturro. People were getting bored with him. The ratings were kind of plateauing. So They find actually kind of a prodigy, son of a very prestigious
Charles Van Buren.
Yeah, Charles Van Buren and Van Doren.
Van Doren.
Yeah, and he gets on the show, played by Ralph Fiennes, and they start feeding people the questions, or not exactly feeding them the questions, but it is fraud. It's fraud, corporate fraud, all right? And they want him back on the show because people are enamored of him. He's not a bad-looking guy. John Turturro looks like John Turturro, you know. And so the ratings get better and better, and he starts to feel worse and worse about it. And then there's a congressional aide who played by
Ed the guy in Northern Exposure. Merle,
yeah, Northern Exposure.
Rob Morrell, that's it.
Rob Morrell, and he has a. The worst thing in the movie is his accent. not really Boston. I don't know where he gets that from, but he senses something kind of hinky going on with NBC, and so he kind of does some investigating, and everything becomes revealed, and it culminates in this really great moment where Charles Van Doren, who is feeling incredibly guilty about everything he's done, kind of confesses everything that he's done to Congress. And it's funny about it. It's a movie, interestingly enough, about how charisma can only get you so far, and also how people want to believe.
And Alan, that's an important aspect for white-collar crime. People want to believe.
Yeah, and until one of the congressional Congress members of the Senate says, you know, I was kind of taught when I was a kid not to do this sort of thing, and you should know better, and they castigate him, and then the story of Charles Van Doren is a really sad one, a kind of tragic one, but I mean, he did it to himself. But he wasn't the only one. He's not, you know, he's not the only problem. And the thing is, everybody punished Charles Van Doren for something that really the corporation had done.
Right. Good point. That's a very good point. And you know, there's a lot of really good points in that movie, but one point that sticks out for me, and one of the things I love about movies is that they're time capsules in the sense mm-hmm. that they show you the attitudes of, you know, various time periods. Now this movie was, what, 90s or 2000s?
Yeah, it came out the same year as Pulp Fiction.
Oh,
it came out it came out a lot. That was a strong movie year, and it kind of got lost under the shuffle of all these other great films that came out here. But it's totally amazing.
But anyway, even though it came out in 94, it's about life in the 50s, mm-hmm. and the host of Quiz Show, the host of the 21, I forget the actor, but he's a really good actor. But, there's a female contestant on the show, and the sexist verbiage of the guy is, and you're like, I'd like to watch one someday with my daughter, but to get her reaction, but it's like, yeah, that's what, you know, I think he says, wow, you're very pretty. What are you doing? You know, what are you doing on this stuff? You should be like, you know, a model or something. That's the highest, you know, for a woman could attain at that point in time.
Like, she's just a housewife.
Exactly.
Right? You know, it's something, exactly.
Just fantastic. Anyway, okay, back to the countdown.
We're going to go to another Scorsese movie. We're going to go to The Color of Money.
Oh, what a great, that's another great movie.
Yeah, and the white collar crime in that aspect is basically pull hall grifters.
Yeah.
Okay? So is it white collar crime? That's kind of a fuzzy line on there, because you could play pool all you want and you could be really great at it, or you could be fake great at it.
Yeah.
And is that a crime to be fake great, to pull money out of people? I don't know. You know, it's like, I guess it is kind of fraud, but it's fraud on such a personal nature.
Exactly.
How do you prove that sort of thing?
And could you give a context overview of the film?
So The Color of Money is a sequel to another great movie called The Hustler. And Martin Scorsese directs the sequel. He brings Paul Newman back, plays Fast Eddie Nelson. Who at this point in his life is no longer playing pool. He's kind of ancillary around bars and stuff, selling liquor and everything like that. And he's probably committing minor league fraud in those aspects too. But he sees this guy who's playing pool, and he's just amazing, and is played by Tom Cruise. And it just sparks something in him to want to get back and play again, and take Cruise on the road, see how much money they can make by kind of grifting small-time dealers. And it's like, he's so good at pool that he can lose on purpose and lose in a way that will have people just forking over money, thinking they could beat this guy, and then they set him up and they swoop in and they take all the money. Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio plays Tom Cruise's girlfriend, who is a little more on the ball than Cruise is. Cruise's character is very naive in how he's being exploited and manipulated, but he savvies up. You know, and towards the end of the film, Cruise kind of realizes his potential. He realizes what's been doing to what Fast Eddie's been doing to him. He goes off on his own, and Fast Eddie says, "Well, you know what? I can do this. I can play pool. I can win as a legit pool player." and they go to this big tournament in, I guess, Atlantic City, and they end up kind of sort of playing against each other. Cruz loses, but he doesn't really lose, because what he ends up doing is like, well, I'm going to lose this pool game, but what's end up happening is I can play pool in the back with the other guys. They want to play against a contender, and I can maybe make a lot more money back there than I can make in the actual winning of the game. And, you know, Paul Newman's character kind of realizes what he's been doing over the past several months, and he kind of finds his dignity again. And
it's a good way of putting it.
And it's a really great film. Whether or not it's a white collar crime exactly, it is a little bit, obviously, because there are people being frauded out with a lot of money.
You said something, Alan, which I think is extremely interesting. And for me, I find this, you know, just a biographical note, there was a proverbial pool hall in my hometown.
Okay.
And I was actually at a university. And, you know, some friends of mine were really good at pool. I was never a very good pool player. But they would run these low-level schemes, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, kids, so what, 50 cents a buck, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But that's a really good question. Is it fraud? Well, technically it is. Well, let's put it this way. Is it fraud? The whole point of fraud is deception. That's the, you know, I talked about this in all my podcasts. You know, fraud is the use of basically using your brains to get what you want. I mean, anybody can hold out a gun and force somebody to turn over their money at threat of violence.
Yeah.
And I've said this before. I have somewhat of an admiration for fraud and white collar criminals, in the sense that they're using the talents that we all have, communication, you know, the ability to look somebody in the eye. And they also have something which I think certainly many of us wish for, is incredible self-confidence,
mm-hmm.
to just get across to people, you can believe in me. And yet in this microcosm that you're talking about of the pool hall, but I always remind you of the Music Man, but in the pool hall, you know, you have this microcosm where you're projecting an image where you don't know what you're doing, and then at the end you pull it off.
Yeah.
And I find that stuff absolutely fascinating. Is it fraud? You know, I don't know.
That's at a basic level, it is.
It is. Yes,
no, but right. Criminal level, is it? No. I can't imagine how you could figure this. You know, it's like you said something interesting to me. It's like, to follow this stuff, you kind of have to admire them in a way. It's really hard to separate the admiration with the, okay, what, but I gotta take you down, man.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you're doing something wrong. I'm just mad that you got there first.
Why did I think of that?
Yeah, no. So
okay, next one.
Let's talk about Sneakers.
Another great movie. Another great movie.
This is directed by Phil Alden Robinson. This is a film he made after Field of Dreams, and this is kind of white collar crime used for good.
Good, yeah.
And where these security guys, run by Robert Redford, Dan Aykroyd, River Phoenix, and David Strathairn, they go into
Sidney Poitier as well.
Yeah, Sidney Poitier. Yeah, they go into systems, bank systems or security systems, to try to crack them, and just to exploit any places that could be exploited, and they end up getting sucked in by one of Robert Redford's former friends in college, who got arrested when they ran. It was the 60s, and at the time they were, you know, they weren't bombing things, but they were I think they figured out a way to get money out of, like,
yeah, it was
like I think the Republican hacking Party or something like that, and they hacked it, and this other guy went to jail. Robert Redford kind of went on the run,
and that was, is that F. Murray Abraham?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, F. Murray Abraham. And he comes back, and he's basically out to get everybody. He's got a new computer-generated system that could basically drain everybody's bank accounts and basically make money worthless. And they bring in Redford and his team to basically stop him. It's a lot of fun.
It is.
It's one of those
very fun movies.
Yeah, it's more light than it sounds. Performances are really great. I love Dan Aykroyd's conspiracy theory.
Yeah, I thought he was great.
Because half of that, he probably genuinely believes.
That's true. Yeah, I've seen some interviews of that guy. He's out there.
Yeah, and that's one of the fun things about it. And Aykroyd and Poitier's. And just them talking to each other, and it's like,
it's great.
And he's just, Poitier's just so frustrated. And so one of River Phoenix's final films, and he's really great in it. And there's one scene in the film where Redford has to get across the room.
Oh, yeah.
But he can't move but like an inch, like every minute.
That's a great scene.
Yeah. And just to get to this terminal. And It's a great film. It's one of those films that when people talk about, like, you lit up when I brought it up. It's like, yeah, that's one of those movies that people love.
There's a great line in there where what's the name of the female lead?
Mary McCormick.
Yes. There's a scene in there where basically Redford, she's an old girlfriend of Redford, and Redford has to set her up on a date with one of the people who work for this company that's run by F. Murray Abraham that Alan talks about. And it's a long series of events. But anyway, it looks like, you know, basically the female character has to get in the room with F. Murray Abraham, and she's complaining about how this guy was dragged. Basically thought she was conning him, so he drags her back to the company.
Yeah.
And, you know, she almost gets away from F. Murray Abraham's character. And she, as she's walking, she says, it's the last time I go on a computer dating service. And then F. Murray Abraham's character says, wait a minute, a computer sit you? You know, and obviously she's a very attractive actress up with him. And the guy who's not very attractive, and he says, I don't think so. Where is he? You know,
look at that. Yeah. It's a really great scene. One of the things that she has to get him to say certain
words. Exactly.
Because everything's voice activated or voice passwords. And he has to get him to say certain words. And one word that doesn't come up in a conversation generally is password.
Yeah, that was a great scene.
So basically, he said everything else. She's got all the words she needs, only missing that one. And she says, I'm so turned on. When the guy says this word, I don't know what it is, but about this word, but I need you to say it for me. Can you say this word? Can you say passport?
Yeah, whatever. it's a great scene.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And, you know, like I said, it kind of uses... And I don't know how much you've talked about this on your podcast, but it's fascinating that the guys who get caught end up...
Oh, yeah, sometimes they do. And that's what I wanted to bring out here. It's actually a lot of times, not a lot of times, I can't say for certain, but I do know that certainly government agencies and even some high-level corporations will retain people that have been caught for white-collar crime. It's like the example with Catch Me If You Can. You know, you hire somebody who... Now, there's a lot of legal and liabilities there, but certainly if somebody knows how to do this, companies often say, look, what are we doing wrong? How would you break into our system? What can you teach us so this doesn't happen?
Yeah.
Which makes sense when you think about it.
Yeah. And I always love that aspect of the movies whenever you see that. There's a lot of movies like that where they kind of turn it back on the bad guys, which is a lot of fun.
Okay, next one.
All right, let's talk about a movie that's not exactly white collar. Well, it's white collar in a way, but it's done by blue collar guys. And it's a movie by Steven Soderbergh, who's done a lot of con movies and not a lot of crime movies. And I could have brought any of them in here, and they would have been fun to talk about. But I want to talk about this one in particular because it's one of the more recent ones he's done. And it's called Logan Lucky.
I haven't seen it.
Okay, you got to see it. You'd like it. Logan Lucky stars Channing Tatum and Adam Driver and a lot of actors, including Daniel Craig, who plays the funniest. I mean, it's really great. He's a prisoner. They bring him out of prison to help with this heist. And he is like a redneck Einstein. You know, it's like, if you've seen the clip from the movie where he's like, I need to know how much this weighs. We're talking about math here. You know, and he has this great, deep Southern accent. But these guys are pulling a heist on, is it either the Daytona 500 or the Indy 500? We're going to basically steal all the cash. And it's a wonderful heist movie in that it's done by a bunch of guys who you not expect to see in a heist. And one of the scenes in the movie, which is, I don't want to spoil it for you, but you're going to laugh. One of the scenes in the movie is that one of them has to start a prison riot so that they can distract some people, some of the security from the race to, right, to go to prison. And one of the things in the prison riot that they get mad at is that they want to know how Game of Thrones ends.
That's great.
And it's like, oh, he hasn't finished the last book. You know, it's like the TV show is there, but he hasn't finished it. And it's like, yeah, and it's like, you mean that Khaleesi bitch? Dragons. It's really funny. I don't want to spoil it because it's one of the funniest parts of the movie.
All right, I'll definitely have to check it out.
Channing Tatum, but they end up successful, but they end up successful in a way that they are almost certain to be caught. So it's not about getting the money out of the racetrack. It's how do you successfully hide it, and that is like the last 30 minutes of the movie, and it's fascinating because One of the things about, and I don't know if you've recovered this on your show, but one of the things about, you can't get all the money that you want to get. You have to burn some of it.
Exactly. That's an excellent point.
And you know, you have to spend money to make money, and you have to, sometimes you have to invest in certain things just to be able to get in the door. And so it's all about, how greedy are you? Can you take the entire pot, or do you leave some? Because you know, if you take the entire pot, you'll get caught. If you take half, you might not get caught, right?
What's that saying? You know, pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a really wonderful film. It's one of the, I mean, Steven Soderbergh has done these kind of movies. Out of Sight is obviously one that we could talk about.
It's a great movie as well.
It's a fantastic film. But this one's not on that level, but it's still really, really good. Highly recommend you check it out.
You know, once again, Alan, to throw in the white collar crime context, you said something which is extremely fascinating and true. Excuse me. Where, you know, one of the ways white collar criminals get ahead and get away with this is it's often the last person you'd expect. Let's pick an easy target, Bernie Madoff. Mm-hmm. You know, he looked like everybody's grandpa. And, you know, Bernie had this, you know, like I know I'm Bernie and I are friends. Bernie Madoff had this idea, and I talked about this in one of my podcasts. One of the ways he got people to invest in his money is invest in his fraud scheme was he always said, you know, look, I've got too many investors already. I can't have you investing in this right now. You have to wait. And they're like, well, no, I really want to invest. Look, yeah. I've got all these investors. I'm sorry, I just don't. Please, Mr. Madoff, please, I really want to. All right, look, talk to my associate. We'll see what I can do. But it's things like that. It's, you know, these psychological tricks. Now, I don't know. I haven't seen the movie, obviously, so I don't know how this plays in there. But like when you describe Daniel Craig, who I think is a wonderful actor, by the way, as this, I got to see it just to hear his redneck accent.
Yeah.
You know, it's just things like that where sometimes that's how white collar criminals often throw people off. They do things you just don't expect.
Yeah, he's great in the movie. I want after the movie came out, I wanted to see his character do Math by Joe Bang. His name's Joe Bang in the movie. And it's like, just to hear him talk. And, you know, as his career has kind of shifted in from Bond to do more interesting things in other ways, like the Knives Out films and things like that, this is kind of the movie that started that. Okay. So if you're interested in seeing Daniel Craig acting like a total loon, and he's really wonderful in it, then
definitely have to. Okay, next.
Okay, let me see what I got on my list. I don't have that much left. Okay, so this one's probably going to be the last one to talk about. This one is only white-collar crime in an ancillary way. One of the characters commits a white-collar crime, but he's busted. And it's a great film, and you know which one I'm going to talk about. It's Midnight Run.
Oh, yes. Okay, what a great movie.
So Charles Grodin is... Robert De Niro's a bounty hunter. Charles Grodin is an embezzler who embezzles the wrong guy. He embezzles the mob, gets the money that he embezzled from the mob, donated to charity, goes on the run, and Robert De Niro's character has to chase him across the country. And the way they end up catching the mob boss is kind of a white-collar crime deal in itself.
Exactly.
Right? So I think it's a good film to talk about when it comes to this subject.
It's a great film. And, you know, I mean, as Alan said, the movie starts with basically Charles Grodin's character committing this crime. Only is it a crime? Well, it is a crime, although he's literally stealing from the right people if you're going to commit a crime against a mob boss. But then again, that's not a really good idea to steal from a mob boss because they tend not to take that stuff very kindly,
no.
Which sets everything in motion. And, the movie was French. It's funny you bring this out, Alan, in that when I saw the movie, that's one of the few movies I saw with my dad. And I know you'd like to talk about how you saw Jaws with your dad.
Yeah.
But this is one of the few movies I saw with my dad, which my dad wasn't from the United States, and he didn't really appreciate a lot of movies that I liked, but we saw Midnight Run together, and he really liked it. When I was watching it, and I don't know how old I was. I don't know if I was in college or not. But anyway, you know, what fascinated me when I first saw it, I think it's still there, it was presented as a buddy movie.
Yeah.
You know, Charles Grodin and Robert De Niro. I think there's a line there even where, you know, if we had met another life, I'd still hate you just as much as I hate you now.
Yeah.
But I always was interested in the fact that, you know, what makes this guy go ahead and steal money like that? And, you know, as I said, in this case, you know, Charles Grodin's character is stealing money from a mob boss. How can you feel? And by the way, Dennis Farina is...
Dennis Farina is the mob boss. He's so good.
He's so good. Oh, I'm sorry. Is this Moore on number one? Let me talk to Moore on number two.
Yeah, it's great. He's great.
And Yaphet Kotto has some great lines as well. There's a whole undercurrent where Robert De Niro steals Yaphet Kotto's name. And so
yeah, he steals his name and his sunglasses.
Yeah, Alonzo, I can't remember.
Yeah.
And so
Alonzo Mosley.
That's right. Yeah. And I remember there's one scene in the movie where one character says, "How many Alonzo Mosleys do you guys have in the FBI?"
Yeah, exactly.
But that's you know, that's what really pointed out to me how, you know, the federal government often gets involved in white collar investigations. And of course, Alonzo Mosley and the FBI get involved. But no, I agree with you in that it's tangentially a white collar criminal movie, but at the same time, I think it brings out an important aspect that, you know, a lot of times, once again, I can only say this so many times, but it's true. You know, you don't really feel sorry for somebody stealing from a mob boss.
No.
And so Charles Grodin's character is, you know, I guess a hero in that sense. But, you know, Charles Grodin's character is an accountant. I think he even has a special nickname. But
the Duke.
The Duke. Oh, yeah. There we go, the Duke. And, it, you know, it's amazing to me how many times you see, and by the way, you can always read online the U.S. Department of Justice's website and see how many people are indicted and ultimately prosecuted for these things. But white collar criminals, a lot of times, are people you need that we trust, like accountants, mm-hmm. sometimes lawyers. And, you know, it's sad in a way because you don't have to be an advanced professional to commit white collar crimes, you know, but it certainly helps in many ways. And I think, you know, when that trust is misplaced, that's what really causes a lot of, you know, people to really have not only faults in the system, but also, what's that old joke? 95% of lawyers give the other 5%, or 5% of lawyers give 95% of that, whatever, you know. But it's unfortunate when professionals do this. Now, like Alan said, you know, the whole point of the movie is you don't feel, you know, Charles Grodin's character is a hero. And there's a great scene in there where he's being threatened by Dennis Farina, who once again does a fantastic job. And but it really brings out, one of the undercurrents that I noticed was that in some way, Dennis Farina's character was hurt by the fact that he was betrayed by his accountant.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. One of the things I do want to talk about a little bit is that this idea of rooting for the white-collar criminal, where there's a scene in Midnight Run where Charles Grodin is basically, he talks a lot. And he's trying That's to talk sure. to De Niro, basically trying to get out of De Niro why he won't let him go. Because, like, were you on my side when I was arrested? And he goes, well, yeah. But now you're my problem. So I'm not on your side now. But yeah, sure, I was on your side. And it's curious, you know, I don't know if this is a stigma. I would imagine it is very much a stigma when it comes to prosecuting these people, because white collar crime is like, well, it's not like he killed somebody, or, you know, he found a loophole in the system, right? And it's like, if he found that loophole, he was able to exploit that loophole. Well, what's wrong with that? You know, and it's like, who's he really hurting? And it's like, well, in this case, he's hurting a mob boss. But what if he had stolen money from grandpa and granny, a homeowner, you know, or figured out a way to exploit other avenues and do other things? And it's like, it's all a matter of degrees. And it's, I always thought that was interesting in that it's easy to root against a mob boss or a gangster. You know exactly what that, but sometimes when you talk about these kind of issues in a movie, a lot of it, like I said before, is like the fantasy of like, well, he did something that I might have gotten away with if I'd done something different. And a lot of the interesting things about these movies mm-hmm. is that you can see the story arc of like, they grabbed one too many apples off the tree and that's how they got busted.
Right.
I wouldn't have grabbed that apple. I would have walked away. But who knows what people do in that situation. Some people, there's a whole lot of apples and, you know, I get three of them and I'm set for life. But God damn it, I gotta get that fourth apple, right?
You know, and that's what I find the most fascinating aspects of white collar crime. I suppose it's true with a lot of criminal acts to begin with anyway, but once again, going back to that saying, hogs get fat, pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered. You know, I think when you work with money, you unconsciously have this need sometimes to get more, especially when you're using illegal means.
Yeah.
And by the way, it goes without saying, Alan is from Houston, by the way. Alan is actually a native Houstonian. You are a native Houstonian. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, I bring that out because I mentioned a lot on my podcast about Enron, and Enron was a huge, you know, huge earthquake for Houston, and for the world, actually, but certainly for Houston. And, you know, and this does have a point to where I'm getting with movies, but, you know, by the way, there is yet... If you have any influence at all, Alan, in the movie industry, tell them to make a good movie about Enron. I mean, that's got...
There is a good doc out there.
The Smartest Guys in the World. Yeah, I've seen that. Actually, my old boss is in that.
See, the thing is, that's a really hard story to tell in a fictional setting because you have to break it down to its essentials for audiences to understand it. And the thing about Enron is how complicated it got at the end.
Well, it did. I agree. But, you know, there's just so much there. I don't know if you remember this, but they had a real crappy TV movie about it. And, I mean, just who? There was a late actor in it. Brian Keaton.
Brian Dennehy?
Yes, Brian Dennehy. Okay, I felt so sorry for Brian Dennehy. I'm like, dude, man, you have to pay your mortgage or something? Is this where you're in this crap? But anyway, the whole thing about Enron, which to me was like, you know, you can always say it's like a Shakespearean tragedy, a Greek tragedy, a lot of ways it was. But when you watch somebody like Jeff Skilling, you know, and Alan points out that there's a documentary out called The Smartest Guys in the Room, which is a great documentary. I highly advise seeing that. But Skilling was this kind of guy who, you know, he graduated at the top of his class for everything. And when he was asked if he was smart, he would say, "I'm not smart. I'm fucking smart." You know, and just came across as just a complete and total asshole. But, you know, he did his job and he made money. Now, one of the things I found that's amazing with white collar criminals is that they find a way to exploit the system. And in many ways, Enron was like that. They exploited the system. These mark-to-market accounting, I mean, there's nothing really wrong with it per se, at least not at the time. But they created this bubble that everybody bought into because everybody's willing to believe. When you look back on it now, it almost seems like a science fiction story. They're like, oh, we have this new way of making money. Nobody understands it but us, you know.
We're
the only ones. You guys are a bunch of dummies out there. Only we get it. But they're making money. It's apparently hand over fist, so who cares? And to me, the reason I mention it like a movie, it had this whole fantasy aspect to it where we look back now after 20 years and we're like, God, how could people believe this crap? You know, I mean, and especially with names like, you know, by the way, this is going to come as a shock. Alan is a huge Star Wars nerd. But with names like, you know, Jedi, Chewie, you know, Corp, and like, didn't they have anybody watch Star Wars at least review these accounting books? I mean,
And in that situation, they got the phrase too big to fail.
Yeah.
And in that situation, it's a company where it's like, well, obviously they can't be frauds. Look how big they are. Right.
At one point, it was the seventh largest company in the United States.
Yeah. And I mean, mutual friend of ours, Tom, he invested in Enron. He ended up losing like $80,000.
Oh, man.
Enron was a financial nuclear bomb that went off in the city. There absolutely should be a good movie about it, but it's kind of feels like it's bigger in a movie. You'll probably make it really
well. You'd have to make it a miniseries, I think. I just think it would be a fan. But the reason I mention that as a movie, and that's a good way to close out our podcast, is, you know, with something like you mentioned with the Midnight Run, you know, we root for Charles Grodin's character in the sense that, yeah, he ripped off a mob boss. There's something noble about that. You know, unwise, but very noble to rip off a mob boss, especially a mob boss like Dennis Farina.
Yeah.
And by the way, one of the last scenes in that movie with, you know, when they're at the airport, when Dennis Farina confronts, he was so chilling.
It's chilling. I'm going to kill your wife.
Yeah. And just like,
you
mentioned earlier with, what was the movie where it's like they're sticking, the insult is so bad. There's
sticking the knife and turning it and making your kids watch.
Yeah. that's what Dennis Farina portrayed. Just like, you know, you crossed me and now you're going to pay the price. And, you know, you brought this on yourself and I'm going to enjoy every minute of watching you suffer before I finally decide to put you out of my misery. It's that sort of thing. But
yeah.
You know, when we watch somebody like Charles Grodin commit this white-collar crime, and like you said, he's exploited the system in the sense that he decided to grow a conscience, but he was involved in, the underlying premise is that he was involved in money laundering for the mob. Mm-hmm. So financially speaking, he knows where the bodies are buried.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when he decides to turn against the mob, he's doing a good thing. Enron, to me, seemed like, you know, it's almost, what is the reverse of that, where they're making money hand over fist, so who cares? But at the same time, the people that are even not remotely involved with Enron, the people who are investing in it one way or another, even, you know, indirectly, they're the ones that ultimately are going to suffer.
Mm-hmm. And they did.
And they did.
Yeah.
I mean, I know people, too, who just lost a lot of money on this. How many pension funds were wiped out? Mm-hmm. I don't know about banks, but how many certainly investment accounts were wiped out? And, you know, with Enron, it was the reverse, where you had the white-collar criminals. I can't help but believe in some way that they, I do believe they knew what they were doing was wrong, but I think they were thinking, as long as money's involved, who cares, as long as everybody's happy.
Yeah.
And they never grew a conscience. It ultimately took somebody like Sharon Watkins to bring them down. You know, even to this day, I don't think some of them even will admit what they did was wrong.
Well, you know, it's like, in these situations, and I'm sure you've seen this, and you talk about it in the show, people get punished. Corporations kind of just walk away, right? But there are some people that end up paying for it, but they were like the lowest person on the pole.
Right.
It's like the one least responsible in the company is the one we can put all this crap on. And and he's the bad guy. Yeah. He got away with it. We're all great,
yeah.
You know, and that seems to happen a lot in this kind of situation.
Yeah, it's yeah. Well, Alan, before I go, I just want to mention the movie Margin Call. I'm surprised you didn't mention that. It's one of my favorite movies. I know you've seen it, obviously.
Yeah.
But this, I guess, I'll talk about the movie a little bit. Margin Call is about indirectly references the mortgage crisis of the 2000s, and it's a movie where it's, I just love the way the movie opens, in that Stanley, and once again, an ensemble cast, absolutely stellar performances by everybody, but Stanley Tucci plays a high-ranking employee at this company who gets fired on this day, and as he's leaving, he hands a IC chip to Zachary Quinto's character and said, check my work. And the reason I love it so much, it's like an onion, you know, you uncover a layer after layer, and it sets the stage where, and this is a big time investment firm on Wall Street, and every few years they just get rid of everybody and start over again, and of course they entice people in with these huge salaries. As a matter of fact, Zachary Quinto's character is revealed to be literally a rocket scientist who says that, you know, the reason I started working here is, quite frankly, the money is better.
Right.
So anyway, and then Zachary Quinto, basically that night, Paul Bettany and one of the other characters goes out for drinks. Well, drinks into a strip club. Well, Zachary Quinto's character is intrigued by what Stanley Tucci's character said about the chip, so he plugs it in, does the math, being a rocket scientist, and suddenly he realizes something's up, and it's horrifying. And he actually goes to the strip club and gets Paul Bettany's character and the other guy. I can't remember the other actor's name, but he explains to them what's going on. And, you know, Paul Bettany is supposed to be over Zachary Quinto's character, and Paul Bettany's like, look, what are you talking about? Just explain it as simply as you possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
And he does. And Paul Bettany's character is like, oh my God. So he calls in Kevin Spacey's character who's over him. And Kevin Spacey comes in. And once again, Paul Bettany tries to explain. He's like, put it in more basic terms, okay? And then, of course, as the movie goes on, finally Jeremy Irons' character comes in, who's the head of the company. And I like one of the lines in that movie, which I think is so fantastic. You know, it's the meeting they're having at 2 a.m. What is eventually revealed is that this company is selling mortgage-backed securities. And because of mortgage-backed, for my international listeners, mortgages in the United States have a different set of laws than most other types of loans and investments. So with mortgage-backed securities, as Zachary Quinto's character reveals, they have to keep them on the books longer than they'd like. In the meantime, because of the housing crash, because basically a mortgage-backed security is where you have maybe 100, 1,000 mortgages tied together, and so they're on the books of this company longer than it should be. And what's happening is that as the housing prices collapse, these mortgages are suddenly worth nothing, but they're still on the books.
Yeah.
And I remember with Jeremy Irons' character, he's supposed to be this genius who runs this, you know, multi-billion-dollar investment firm. You know, he turns to Zachary Quinto's character and said, you know, keep in mind this is a meeting at 2 a.m. with the entire board there because it's such an emergency. Sir, please explain this to me as you would a golden retriever. And I love it. It's like the higher you go up in the food chain of this company, the less they understand.
That's. I haven't seen Margin Call, so I need to see.
Okay, it. Now it's my turn to say you need to see it.
Yeah, absolutely. I haven't seen Margin Call, but you know, it's funny because this sounds like a movie I probably like. Like, there's another movie that covers this subject matter called The Big Short.
Yes, great
movie. And it's a good movie. This sounds better. The reason that I kind of downgrade The Big Short is that The Big Short is constantly poking its finger at you.
Yeah, exactly.
That's like, I can explain this to you, but you're not going to get it. And that's kind of an asshole.
I agree. You know? I agree.
So this is a movie that sounds like this. Like,
oh,
let's
put
you through the steps of how this goes.
It's fantastic. Instead of,
well, here's step 1 through 3. You know what? I'm not going to bother to explain step 12 because right. You're just not going to get
exactly,
it.
Exactly.
You know? And that's kind of...
It's a really great movie with, like I said, outstanding performances. And there's a... It's as Alan said before, Kevin Spacey got into all this trouble, but Kevin Spacey does a fantastic job.
Yeah, when he was on,
he was on. Yeah,
exactly. But yeah, definitely need to check out.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Well, Alan, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to be here today. I really do appreciate it. Over the last 2 days, so we can finish this podcast. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Hopefully, you'll check out these movies. I think Alan and I have been talking about this for the past couple hours. You know, fraud and white collar crime, I think, are tailor-made for the movie screen, and they're also tailor-made for plays, in that you can really express a lot, because it doesn't require, I mean, quality of the acting, of course, is important, but it doesn't require big-budget shootouts or big-budget kung fu fights or special effects or anything like that. It's just human interaction, and that human interaction is so important, because fraud and white-collar crime is based on human interaction. You know, I've said it before, and I'll keep on saying it. Anybody can take a gun and point it at somebody else and use the threat of violence to demand that you turn over your money. But to get you to make you want to turn over your money, that's a skill.
Yeah, I love the movies that we've talked about today, and it is a fascinating aspect. And I do feel it's cinematic. It's not cinematic in the way of a grand like battle scene or a shootout or anything. It's cinematic in the audience, and we know something that somebody else on the screen doesn't know. And it's also, like I said, a fantasy where we can kind of play in our heads, what if we were in this situation? It's really easy to watch these films and put yourself in those places and wonder how you would react. A lot of great white-collar crime films and movies like we talked about are litmus tests for us.
That is a great way of looking at it.
As individuals and as our morals and how our morals get tested. And the constant question I think that people ask in movies like this is, well, who's getting two questions really? How can I get out of this? And the second question is, who's getting hurt?
Yeah.
And just because you can't really see who's getting hurt, because we don't see the branches of the tree, we're all in the trunk. We're not on the ancillary parts of the tree. But there are people getting hurt to these things. It's just it's hard. They're really good movies can show the transitional effects of a decision made in a boardroom or a decision made on a computer screen that can affect somebody else. Down the road, there's a movie coming this year. It's probably, I don't know if it's out yet, but it's a Jason Statham actioner. Okay, The Beekeeper. But the premise of the movie is that one of the characters in the movie, his neighbor, gets in a computer fraud where her computer locks up and says, "Call this number, we can fix it." She calls it and says, "Okay, we need your bank account number to withdraw the money." They take all her money and they don't give her a fixed computer, and then she ends up killing herself because of what happened. White collar. It's a Jason Statham. Well, maybe we'll cover that next time. Jason Statham goes and kicks everybody's ass at the end of the day.
But white collar is involved.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, these issues are important. And especially now when it's a hard world to navigate these days. And people are getting away with it more often than not. This stuff is really hard to track down and go after. So being able to recognize certain aspects of it is important.
And, you know, not to get too philosophical, but I think it's one of the more important ways movies like this really help is that, you know, I mean, I was introduced to the world of white-collar fraud through, indirectly, Midnight Run.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's things that, unless you're an accountant or an attorney, especially in financial crimes or something like that, you don't really think about. But, you know, I guess the guy who holds up somebody in a back alley, you know, obviously the person he robs is traumatized by it. But somebody like Bernie Madoff, you know, he destroyed how many thousands of lives? How many thousands of lives did Enron destroy?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm always reminded of that scene in, going back to movies, the movie Fargo, you know, when the main character... the sheriff.
Frances McDormand.
Yes, Frances McDormand. You know, when she's driving, after she's finally caught the guy and he's putting his buddy in the wood chipper, you know?
Yeah.
And she says, you know, it's a beautiful day out, and you know, what do you do this for? A couple bucks, some money? I mean, is this why you caused all this, just for some money? It's a beautiful day out, you know, and you can't appreciate that.
I just find that
very poignant. Anyway, Alan, thanks again, shaking Alan's hand, and hope everybody has a great 2024.
Cool, man.
All right.